back to the 9-8 podcast, the home of progressive and underground music right here in Australia. My name is Alex Hogg, and Dave's not here this week. This week, I'm talking to two guys from Kripke's Illusion, Jesse and Christian. So I thought we'd kick it off by talking about the origins of the band. How did the band get started?
Early days. The way me and Jesse met, me and Sean were previously in another band called Capricorn, and that fizzled. We were looking for a new singer. Jesse contacted us, and basically just every time we set up a jam, we just couldn't organize it. So I said, dude, you got any like material yourself? So he sent me some of his tracks, and I said, well, I want to continue doing music. Let's do your music, since Capricorn was fizzling. And I'm like, oi, Sean, you want to do this? And he's like, yeah, let's do that. So that's how the band started. But I think when we first met, he was wearing a Wake shirt, and I was wearing my Rush shirt. And we're like, we should start a band, eh?
Yeah. So Capricorn was in a sort of prog vein as well? Or was
it's more symphonic metal sort of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
With a pretty operatic female singer.
Okay. Cool.
So like proggy and Nightwish kind of situation.
Yeah. Okay.
Kind of Nightwish, Edenbridge sort of style, yeah.
So we sort of already mentioned you guys are both influenced by sort of prog metal kind of stuff. I mean, what sort of stuff were you listening to growing up?
I would say K-Man's probably more influenced by proggier stuff because he knew it before I did. I came into the band sort of as a heavy metal or like sort of older rock style sort of person. I listened to Van Halen and like Iron Maiden and Metallica, and Van Halen was
the first band that like pretty much it was my favorite band, Van Halen, back in the day.
So we're more of like the less proggier dudes in the band, really, to be honest. We're like the hard rock sort of old school influence to the band.
Yeah, I mean, I was exposed from a very early age to prog. Like my dad's Zappa freak, Genesis, ELP. I mean, he's just one of these. Like he used to have all the Beatles records, and then he found Zappa, and so he sold all the Beatles and then went down that tangent. And, you know, I vividly remember listening to Close to the Edge when I was like, what, 10, 11? And I was like, this is a bloody good song, Dad.
Yeah. Yeah.
Different to when I first heard it. I was like, what the fuck is this noise?
Yeah. Fair enough. So the other members of the band, Dario and Sam?
Sean, sorry.
So Dario and Sean, they're more into the prog kind of sphere. And I've seen Dario's bass playing. He's always very much influenced. I mean, the sound that he gets is sort of reminds me of kind of a Chris Squire, Billy Sheehan sort of vibe.
Brilliant. He would love to hear that. And I love those bass players. I mean, I would say that Dario is kind of, he's a musical absorber. He'll listen to anything, and I mean literally anything, even if I think it's horrible. But he's like, listen to that bass or listen to this snare.
He usually has weird ears.
Yeah, he usually has weird ears, picks up subtle things in songs that you would never think to get inspiration from, but he's all over it in that aspect. But I'm always showing him new prog bands, but mainly because Sean shows me all these new prog bands. And
what sort of stuff are we talking about?
Like new bands?
Yeah.
Well, Sean constantly just shows me, like, because he's always on progarchives.com, and he just gets down that rabbit hole and he goes and filters and sends me stuff. So I think the last band he sent me was, told me to check out was Unexpect.
Okay.
From Montreal.
Don't think I've heard of that one.
They're
a bit off chops. Yeah.
They are like very, very, very capable musicians, but it's like death metal mixed with like fairy sort of poppy stuff occasionally. It's all over the shop. It's stuff you don't expect.
Okay. I'll have to check that out myself.
Prepare for like some scream metal sort of like vocals.
Yeah.
Occasionally not so great to listen to, but the musicians are fucking crazy to hear.
Yeah, it's cool. So, Jesse, you sort of mentioned that you were influenced by the sort of classic rock, kind of Van Halen sort of stuff. When it comes to your singing, you sort of thinking in that sort of space, the sort of Deep Purple, Dream Theater, Rush, those sort of guys?
Yeah.
Sammy Hagar.
As far as, influence goes, my voice was different when I was younger. I was singing different music. So I was singing stuff that was more influenced by AC/DC and Guns N' Roses and like Motley Crue and things like that. So that was where my influence was, those sort of like iconic singers that were in those kind of bands. Motley Crue was a big phase for me. I went through that when I was 14, 15. That was probably one of the first things I tried to sing. And Twisted Sister was another one.
Oh, yeah.
So I was a big fan of his voice, and I pretty much practiced singing all those things until I eventually reached like Metallica. That was the next thing for my sort of to get more harsh, I suppose, with vocals and Iron Maiden. That was a bit of a lesson in singing. So I was obsessed with
all the high stuff.
Yeah. And Skid Row was a big part of my sort of influence on my voice. Sebastian Bach, he's probably one of the best vocalists of all time, I'd say. Oh,
absolutely.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Some people have said my tone's a little bit like Sebastian Bach's, like probably not with Kripke's because that's soft, kind of softer singing.
Yeah.
When I've sung other stuff like maybe karaoke or when I've done like heavier music. And found Dream Theater and then off I went.
Because you guys have covered Dream Theater live. Or was that your last gig? You guys covered Wait for Sleep.
Yeah.
It's a really good cover, actually. I told you guys before, I was like, if you told me, I would have recorded it. And
you were a bit upset about it.
Yeah, I was like, if you told me, I would have recorded it.
I'm sure.
I do believe somebody recorded it. I don't know where it is, but someone did record it.
That'd be good to have. We have to find out who that is.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll do it again eventually. I mean, it literally takes half the band to do it. It's Jesse and Sean and me and Barry walk off stage. It's a great little interlude for us to have a break, but I mean, we only get half an hour. You don't really need a break as the drummer.
Yeah.
I think Sean just does it for me. It's a bit of a selfish thing on my part, I think.
Fair enough. It's such a nice ballad. Everyone likes to hear it.
Yeah, it is. It's a nice change as well. You've got all the real heavy stuff and the big keyboards and stuff, and then you just, okay, we're going to do something softer.
Yeah, we like to change it up a bit, eh? Especially because it was a proclamation gig, so we're like, we better kind of do something a bit more.
Especially when Daniel Wiggins then came on and covered a Porcupine Tree song.
Yeah, because I saw his drummer. I can't remember his name for the life of me right now. But
Rolf.
Yeah. I literally saw Wiggins put up a little video clip of the drum beat, and he's like, guess which song we're going to be doing? I'm like, there's only one song where that bloody thing fits to, so it has to be that. Expected it, and I still didn't bother recording it.
somebody recorded it, I think.
Good.
I did see. Someone recorded a portion of it because he put something up.
I don't think
it was the whole song.
I think it was his Mrs. Amanda. She was walking around with a camera.
Yeah. She may have recorded your cover as well. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Might have to get onto Wiggins then.
Man. Yeah. Get in touch with him, see if he's got it.
Actually, I do have a. When you did a gig with them in Fremantle, with Wiggins, and you did Halo.
That's right,
They did a cover of Halo. I've got a video of that on my phone, actually, yeah.
That was going to be my next question, actually. What other stuff would you like to cover?
There's so many songs. Yeah.
But I'm not that good of a guitarist to cover a lot of shit like Dream Theater and Haken and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I thought it'd be kind of fun to see you guys cover like YYZ or something like that, but that's a tour de force. That would be
fun. We did do a bit of 2112 at that other gig.
Yeah, we did a 70s tribute thing.
We did Kansas. That was a good
Carry On Wayward Son. We did Sunrise by Uriah Heep. The one we were just talking about, Rush, 2112 Discovery.
It was just like the back end of it, sort of section-ish. Hard to, you're not going to play a 30-minute piece.
No, especially when you've got like, you know, I suppose that, I know Dream Theater talked about that as well. They didn't really play A Change of Seasons a lot early in the early days because they were opening and they only had like a 20-30 minute slot. They're going to walk out, play two songs and then go home. It doesn't quite work.
Yeah. I love the song though. I mean, I remember seeing Morphica play it. That was a bloody good cover.
Okay.
Is it bad to say on this podcast that I'm not a big fan of that song?
I'm not either, actually. So.
Oh, yes.
I'm a fan of all Dream Theater unless it's like, after Dramatic Turn Events, that's when I'm always a bit more iffy.
Yeah?
Yeah.
How's that?
I think because that's pretty much when I discovered Haken, I'm like, well, I need to invest some time in this other band, and then
hopefully Dream Theater release something good later.
Stay tuned on the Haken front.
Yeah?
I can't tell.
Well, I know that they're probably not going to come to Perth, but
they aren't coming to Perth on the next tour, no. Which is annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that is a band that I would fly.
It was a kind of good turnout when they did come, but not good enough.
I missed it. Well, I missed a gig because I wasn't here.
Yeah.
No, it was great.
They played all the best songs.
Yeah.
They played all the best songs.
Except for the Shadow Fortress one. That was good.
Yeah.
I think that probably opened a few people up to Haken who may not have known about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though the turnouts for those gigs were pretty terrible.
Yeah, they weren't that great, eh?
No, there was only a couple of hundred people at the Perth show.
Yeah. I could see it on Portnoy's face.
Mm.
Like, he looked a bit pissed off, I think.
Yeah.
And he actually, like, had a fumble as well, like a little.
Oh.
But the only time I've noticed Mike really fuck up anything.
Oh, do tell. Where was it?
I can't remember, but yeah. I envision it. I can see it. And
it's like,
where
it's
was it?
Permanently ingrained in your head now.
I might have been, like, somewhere in the glass prison or something. Mm. I'm good. Yeah. Where was that? But anyway, I've seen it. Oh. It happened. He's not invincible.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure there's plenty of like drum clams live that you see.
There's heaps.
Yeah.
Some of them are absolutely hilarious, but then some of them you're just like, you got to feel sympathy for the guy because you're like, that's going to happen to me eventually.
And the
too.
Other thing, especially with people recording stuff in gigs, which is a whole other topic we can get to later. Someone stuffs something up live, you could bet the house it's going to be on the internet and people are going to see it. You know, it's like, hey, look, he's bugging it up. And he stuffed that thing up.
I think you said on another podcast, like some singer wouldn't even go out because he was afraid, you know, that he wasn't up to par. He didn't want to, you know, give a bad performance and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. I know Robert Fripp doesn't particularly like being recorded. He's like, I think there's a video on the internet somewhere where you can see like a photo flash has gone off and he's been actively startled by it and then cocked up a guitar part, which in their complicated world of music is a whole other problem. There's a great train wreck online of The Construction of Light where I think Tony Levin came in one beat too early. Ooh. And because all eight of them are playing in a different time signature, that it turns the whole thing into a hilarious train wreck.
Shit.
And because then Tony spoke about it online, and was like, oh, yeah, there was a bit of a cock up there and it was all my fault. Blah, blah. And then they got together and had a meeting the following day and they're like, yeah, we're going to have to put that online. We're going to put that track up.
Oh.
And so it's a download. You could find it. I think it was in San Francisco.
I guess.
Because they record everything.
Yeah. And but then it's intriguing to hear one of your, like, I mean, it's King Crimson, for fuck's sake, and they mess up. How?
Because it was such a complicated thing. Tone, like they're all playing in, I don't know what the hell time signatures they're playing in, but you could see, I was seeing them play that song live, and you could see Gavin Harrison physically counting because he's playing in four or five, I think he's playing in 5/4 or something. The drummer next to him is playing in 7, someone else is playing in 9. Tony Levin's in some other time signature, and he's having to sit there and physically count the beat. You can see him literally going 1, 2, 3, and you're like, man, if he's having to count the damn thing out.
Yeah,
who knows what's going on there?
I mean, like, no better man behind the skins for that project. I mean, Gavin is.
Yeah.
Oof.
Yep.
I would think that would take some of the joy away from performing.
Potentially, but
having it's so complicated, doesn't it take something away?
But if you nail it, though, if you get it right and you know, I've got it right.
Yeah.
If you don't have to pay as much attention and you can nail it and it just,
because it's such a big project as well. Like, I mean, there's three drummers. So
three drummers, there's eight of them, nine of them in the band now.
Jeez.
I'm just trying to remember the last time I saw them.
The last time I saw them
in Poland, I was like, hang on, where are they all on the stage? Yeah.
This guy has seen every band
I've seen King Crimson play a bunch of times quite recently. All of them in Poland, actually.
Yeah, but now you're going to go over and
see
them again.
And now I'm going to go and see them in the Royal Albert Hall in London. Yes, I know. I'm a bastard. Dave keeps telling me all the time. They do play in Japan they are coming to Japan fairly regularly these days. The promoter obviously over there loves them. So
Japan would like mop them up too.
Yeah.
They would, yeah. Play, they love all that stuff. So yeah, that would be my suggestion. If they're going to play anywhere that's nearby, Japan is probably the place to go.
It's like the closest place is Japan.
That's where I want to go too.
Well, it's on the same time zone too, so you're not even going to worry about jet lag.
I've always wanted to go to Japan.
Not quite the same time zone as us. I think they're an hour ahead, but yeah.
Close enough. It's like no less than go to Melbourne.
Yeah, true. Costs about the same. So how do you guys write? Who is there? You all sort of get together in a room and jam, or is it someone coming up with a part and then you adding on? What's the process to write?
We use variations. Sometimes it will be Jesse's basically got like a song structure, everything together. We'll record it and I'll send it to the guys and people add their bits and then we'll jam it out and it will evolve from there. There's been times where we just are all in the room and usually Jesse has a guitar line or Sean has a piano line.
At least something to start it with.
Yeah, and then we just literally jam. And then when it's me, Sean and Jesse in the room, like Daria is not so much about wanting to compose and like write. He'll write to the finished product. He's happy for us to compose the song. And I'm happy to work with Daria in that way because he just wants to be
a simple freak of nature that just plays wicked bass.
Yeah, and
he's happy.
More than happy for him to do that in our band because the more stuff that he does on the bass, I'm always just jaw-dropping basically from watching him play. It's great to see.
It's interesting you guys build it up from pretty much guitar, keyboards and drums. Mm. The other bands tend to sort of bass and drums. It's an interesting way to come up with the parts.
Well,
I mean, we wrote a lot of earlier stuff, just me and K-Man, just drums and guitar.
Yeah, okay.
It was more riff-based, but
keys sort of become more of a textural thing rather than the lead.
Yeah, well, the first one was Waves, our instrumental, and that was just me and Jesse in this room, and we were just going, next riff, all right.
Yeah.
Right, have a quiet bit here now.
I just had a bit of an idea what the rest of the thing sounded like. And then
Sean just literally laid keys on it. And
he just went crazy and just wrote stuff on it. Yeah.
Quite naturally, like some things like Dreamland State, we wrote that in a day and like had it pretty much fleshed out in a couple of hours basically. But
if we have a good jam, then we'll structure the whole song in that one jam.
Yeah. Fortitude took at least two or three jams to kind of piece things together. But
which was pretty much led by Dario.
Yeah, the one time he was in the room to actually compose. But he gets a bit like I don't know, because we always change. So he's, committed to the idea. And if we change or Sean changes, some chord progressions or adds more on the low end, Dario's like, stop messing with my bass. He gets frustrated.
He's then got to kind of rekey the bass into the left hand.
And he doesn't want to.
He doesn't want to do it.
Yeah. I mean, which is fine. But like having Sean, set in his, if he's structured the song and written it in the way that he wants, then Dario is going to compose around what Sean's done. But then when we improv, sometimes chords change, lines go a bit faster or longer, and then Dario's
usually
like,
Sean and Dario,
because Sean's got he has a degree in music, so the rest of you guys are mostly self-taught, I guess. Have you taken
I had drum lessons from the West Australian Symphony Orchestra drummer back in the day, Steve. I can't remember his last name. But I met him down at Classic Sounds. He was just handing out cards and mum's like, yeah, we'll get some drum lessons. And he brought the own drum kit around.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was good.
I'm 100% self-taught. Cool. Just listening, YouTube,
When it comes to guitar players, who are you influenced by and who do you really like listening to? Sometimes those two lists are different. Sometimes they're the same.
Yeah. Well, I've got phases in my life. So it's like what started me on guitar was Angus Young.
Yep.
That made me get a guitar or ask for one for Christmas, and that's what I got on my 14th birthday. And then, so I played AC/DC for probably like a year, just learning all the riffs.
Good place to start, I suppose.
Yeah, it's good to learn your chords and all that.
Simple sort of blues patterns as well.
Yeah, and then
Slash was my... But with the two guitars, it's not that easy to do just back and black. It's not as...
Their riffs are two part riffs. Like they guitars go together doing something different and they fit in.
Yeah, you can make it sound like a song with one guitar, but
to get it properly as it is on the record, you need both.
Yeah, yep. they're doing different things.
When you hear 5.1 and if you're missing a speaker or something, then you're losing one guitar. You can't hear the other guitar. Yeah. Like you hear that part, or you hear that Angus Young usually does a little sort of higher version of the riff. With a little flick or something.
Okay.
And Malcolm just doing the chuggy sort of heavier stuff. But when one's missing, it sounds off, it sounds wrong. Yeah.
Great guitar team.
So that was my first thing. And then I got into Slash for a while. Slash was a big influence. Like, you probably hear some of that. Oh, yeah, I've got that Slash.
Jesse showing me his tattoo of Slash on his arm.
And there's Eddie there down there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so Slash was a big influence on my feel, I suppose, with solos and things like that. Not really much of the riffs because I didn't really take much away from their rhythm work, but yeah, and then Petrucci. That took over my life for a little bit.
Yep.
And yeah, no, recently I've been loving Guthrie and just, yeah, the Haken guys are pretty exceptional. Mm. Yeah. I was influenced a lot by like 80s sort of guitarist, like the guitarist for Bryan Adams, sadly enough. Like, he was just, I really thing. Dig the,
no,
well, I dig but, like the, I don't know, that really feathery 80s sort of kind of palm muty, plucky, nice, lush guitar stuff.
I always thought that came from U2.
U2?
It came from U2 and then others sort of took it into, maybe it was, I don't know whether it came from U2. I know that like the Police were sort of in that.
Yeah.
One of the albums was pretty much that sort of sound.
Yes, it was, yeah.
So I was still trying to figure out where it came from, who started it.
I'm not actually sure. I would assume it maybe came from like Motown and stuff because that's kind of where like
bass was.
And they, because most of the time they didn't have like a drummer sort of thing at the time. It was like kind of they used the bass to kind of manipulate with the slap for the kick and snare.
Yeah, fair enough.
Maybe they did that with the guitar if they didn't have a drummer maybe.
Motown, I would have thought the guitar was more, yeah, like, I don't know, rhythmic, kind of like funky.
That's what I'm assuming, like, you know.
Yeah.
Motown as well, you've got the horns to work into that section as well, so, yeah.
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not a guitarist.
Yeah.
Neither am I.
Neither am I.
Oh, I just play it. So I might as well get to the gear that you use. What do you use to get your particular guitar tone?
I use an Avid 11 rack because it's cheap and I'm broke. So that's the best I can do as far as the rack sort of gear goes. I just pretty much play around with it until I find what I like, sort of what I've always done with amps, like going for that 80s metal like tone or some like classic sound, and heaps of reverb on my lead. Like,
but didn't you start to model it with the Bryan Adams tone?
Yeah, I tried to because for some reason someone left heaps of presets on my rack before I got it.
Oh, yeah.
And it had heaps of orange amp like sort of
combos and
things.
Stuff, yeah.
Okay.
So I found one that sounded, because the guy from Bryan Adams uses orange. So I found kind of something similar to his, and then I dialed that into my sort of heavier tone and come up with my tone, yeah.
Okay.
Like, I wanted heavy and chunk, but also glassy and really easy to play chords with, and so it didn't just fuzz out, like, so it sounded nice and, like, clean.
Yeah, I've met some guitar players who get really, really, really obsessed with the tone and all that sort of thing. You tend to sort of play it on more of a kind of a feel.
Yeah, whatever I'm feeling. Like, if I feel like it's not me anymore, then I'll go a different way and just change it, but yeah.
It's changed during recording sessions.
Yeah, we've got sort of same sessions where it's different.
Like, even the solo tone is, you can noticeably hear the difference. Like, it sounds like a different guitar, but it's like, no, this is definitely the same tone. I'm like, fuck, I don't think so.
Yeah, it was a confusing time.
Fun time.
Yeah.
I think that's. Yeah. Oh, I play Fender Strat. That's the guitar.
Yep. Cool.
With Crunch Lab, John Petrucci Crunch Lab in the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of it's pretty stock.
Fair enough. What about your drums?
I'm mainly a Tama guy, but I will play any drum that sounds good basically to me.
Sometimes you don't get a choice, I imagine, when you're playing live. You kind of get whatever has been provided for you
cases. Pretty much, and that's why I've decided to downsize the kit, because usually, like, no one supplies, you know, four toms.
Yep.
So I'm like, well, at least three's, you know, not that much.
Mm.
And even if, you know, they only got one rack tom and one floor tom, I can kind of make things work. But my equipment is, it's not overly expensive. It's just a Tama Super Hyperdrive, the one I'm using now, with a Mapex 13-inch drum, snare drum. And then my other kit is a Tama Star Classic, That's like a 7-piece, bloody good big kit.
Mm.
That's what I use my lotto money for. But I haven't used it for ages because this one's, I like the shorter shells on this tom. So you can lower it a lot nicer and get a bit more separation from the overheads.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, other than that, mainly Tama gear, Vic Firth sticks, and not using tone control things on the toms makes it a lot more comfortable to play now, so I'm not smashing the crap out of them anymore.
Fair enough. Yeah, I've seen like the drummers will talk about, you see, you know, like the prog drum kits where they've got 1,000 drums. You can tell that A, they don't pay for their drums, and B, they don't have to set them up.
Shit, yeah. Or move them. Like,
yeah,
moving
exactly.
them
they've
is
got,
one thing.
We've
like.
Got, they've got techs and people to do all that for them. They just rock up and play, basically turn up and play. Yeah.
Lucky bastards.
Yeah.
Wasn't Carl Palmer, did he have like a 1-ton kit?
Yeah, it was made out of stainless steel, man.
And they needed trucks because of mainly because of that kit.
Yeah, I think that's like,
ELP days they went big crazy because the Keith Emerson had the big Moog thing that was like a 2-story building almost. Yeah,
it was like a massive bookshelf.
I assume that Hammond was pretty fucking...
Yeah, the Hammond, well, they had a couple of Hammond organs and then, you know, the Mellotron, which was always a little bitch to keep
bloody,
in tune.
Yeah, but... They all weigh a lot to move. Like,
well, those Mellotrons are bloody huge.
Fuck yeah.
They are big bastards, those things.
And now all of the sounds come in one.
Yeah. Now everything's a synth and everything lives in the computer.
I love it. When technology makes that stuff so much easier, like, I mean, Sean himself is downsized. Like, we in Capricorn, he had, like, stacks of keyboards, you know, a Moog or Mini Moog had like a big Korg keyboard and then his big Yamaha keyboard with all different sounds and all different patches and crap going through it. But now we're literally, because when we gig, we don't want to have all this shit going wrong and, you know, you got 15-minute changeover.
Especially synthesizers. I mean, and how many times have you seen a band live and the synth craps out and they've like got to sit there and work? There's a great clip on YouTube, actually, when Devin Townsend played... At Big Prog, my friend.
Ah.
The synths crapped out behind him, but as they were going on, they went to play the bit and something fucked up. And he was like out front for 20 minutes doing what Devin does best, talk rubbish and crap on. It's on YouTube. You gotta have a look at it.
I will.
Yeah. And while they're in the back trying to fix the synths up, make the, you know, reboot, whatever, they have to reboot. And it's him out front just... Yeah, he's got his guitar there. He's playing some stuff and he's just talking rubbish and doing what... It's fantastic.
And I mean, I was in
the audience when they're happening. I was looking around thinking, I was looking at this thing going on and I'm like, someone somewhere better be recording this.
Yeah.
Someone better have tape rolling somewhere.
But you seem to have this sort of like tendency that you don't record things. You're like, fuck, I hope someone records this.
Yeah, which then comes into the problem where... I've been at concerts where someone hasn't literally an iPad.
Oh, wankers.
Yeah, an iPad in the front. It's like, mate, come on.
Yeah.
Like, please put your iPad away.
Enjoy the experience.
You see these people at gigs and they're like watching it through the phone. It's like, come on, man. Like, you can watch it at home on your phone. Like, you're there. Just look.
Yep. Okay, when stuff like that happens, whoever was recording it did a pretty good job of recording it. It doesn't sound completely terrible, as you've seen in other gigs where it just sounds like ass. Yeah, it looks like it's been recorded with a potato. So speaking of playing live, you guys have done a couple of opening gigs. You guys opened for Lepros a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
We get questions on the podcast all the time from our listeners how to get on the opening slot. How does that concept work? We've had David from Chaos Divine talk about this on a previous show. How did that process happen for you guys?
How did you
get on the show?
Because I want to know.
What did he say? We want to know.
I think what he said was that basically he just like bombed. They just put like sort of a big sort of bombing campaign of promoters like all the time, like sending, you know, press kits, that sort of stuff of them playing live. Apparently it also goes off Spotify plays these days.
Oh, wow.
Really?
Yeah.
We're not even on Spotify yet.
Yeah.
Man.
There's so many. Well, okay, all right, we'll jump to that now. Why not? I know some musicians have rather sniffy attitudes towards streaming. They're like, no, it's like the devil incarnate and it's going to destroy the whole music industry.
No. I mean, it's not like the musician's best friend, but
it's not helping, but it's... Yeah, it's there. So what are you going to do about it?
It's used by everyone. So it's like kind of saying, don't use the internet because it's really handy and there's so much content, but don't use it because it's, you know, not going to give you money. It's, I don't know, being in a prog band as well, like, we do it because we love it. I mean, we like this music. It's, if you were going to be doing this for money, I would assume you wouldn't be choosing prog to begin with.
If you were going to be doing anything for money, I wouldn't suggest music.
Exactly.
You know, let's be clear about these things. The music, it doesn't pay that much anymore.
No.
Unless you're Taylor Swift or Ed Sheeran.
Didn't you say Devin only earned 50 grand? That's disgrace. He should be earning a lot more
And that was like a year when he was touring, when he was flogging his guts out on the road touring. And once he paid everybody off, he made 50 grand.
Still earning more than me.
Dave said the same thing as well. He's like, you know, if I could make 50 grand a year playing music, I'd sign on the dotted line right now.
Same.
You know,
exactly. I think I'm on 47
that's
grand.
Part of the problem is, I think that's also part of the thing as well, is that there is, it used to be back in the 70s. I think it was Mike Portnoy who said this. It's like back in the 70s, there were hundreds of bands making millions of dollars. Now there are millions of bands making hundreds of dollars. I'm sure there are plenty of bands out there who don't make anything.
I mean,
Mike Mills lost $5,000 on his Progfest.
That was a great show as well.
It was a great show, but when he played in Sydney as well, he played pretty much the same set that we saw him play in Perth, actually. He was fantastic.
I still highly admire that guy. His guitaring, his voice, I mean, and just like he can play everything.
And he writes it. Everything's written. He does all the drums, the keyboards, everything. There's a great, we were talking before about a YouTube video where he breaks down pretty much like individual track by individual track how he's written the song. And it's like,
I'd like to see that.
Everything's a plug-in effective. Like TLDR, everything's a plug-in. All these guitar sounds, it's like this guitar sound comes from this plug-in, this synth thing comes from this, and then he built like a synth where it's his voice is an individual note on the keys and he's playing
Stephen
like
Stephen Wilson did
thing.
That as well, I think. Put his voice to like all the notes to actually have an orchestra of just like his voice.
See, I think Dream Theater should do that because they've got that kind of fake choir sound that's pretty much on everything. I reckon they could do that with James LeBrie and have something that sounds.
I think someone else.
LeBrie could do it easily.
He'd be good to be like as the orchestra, I reckon, like as the choir, whatever. And then they could just get Tommy Karavik and he could be the lead singer. That's what I reckon.
We've had this personal discussion about like
this is not a conversation this is totally not a conversation I haven't had before. James LeBrie is the lead singer of Dream Theater. Thumbs up, thumbs down. What do you think? You know, this is not a conversation I have heard at any point in time at all before.
Me neither.
I like him. And I mean, there's many people that could take his job, but I don't think it would be right.
Well, it wouldn't be Dream Theater anymore, would it?
No, exactly.
No.
It's very hard to get.
I'm just happy we got that early stuff, that really killer vocals
out. Like in the early 2000s, they did sort of give him a shape up or ship out note. He wasn't exactly up to scratch, and they sort of said, hey, buddy, come on, pick it up.
It did get better, like towards one of my favorite albums, like just tone wise of his voice, is probably Black Clouds. He was pretty not like amazing, but he was solid. For what he was.
Personally, we can all argue the toss about what we think of The Astonishing. I personally think he did an amazing job with The Astonishing. He got handed a Herculean task of different characters.
Yeah, I don't recognize the characters that much though.
That is part of the problem. Yeah,
like
it's sort of. I mean,
it's still him.
You kind of have
trying.
To have different singers
I did
for
talk
that
about
kind
with
thing.
Another friend of the show, Kale. He was talking about what if that album was an Aerion album.
Yeah.
And having distinct four or five different people playing the four or five different characters.
I still think and no offense to Dream Theater because they're one of my all-time fucking bands. But that album, it's written very songs don't move me. I mean, they're supposed to, and I'm sorry, but the story alone does not make me want to be inspired to listen to the whole album in that headspace. Adam, we had a listening party for it and everything. My mate comes around, he gives me the whole spiel, what the story's about.
He loved
it.
The thing that there are two parts of that. Number one, if you lashed out the money that I did for the deluxe edition, it comes with a whole screenplay thing, which does make an add to it. The second part of it, I think, is because we never saw it live.
Yes.
And there won't be a live DVD for it. If there was a live DVD, it's kind of like, I've mentioned this on the show plenty of times before about Marillion's Brave. Mm-hmm. That's quite a difficult record to get your head around.
Yeah.
See it live, though. It's like, okay, now I get it.
Yeah.
Same kind of problem with The Astonishing, I say.
Yeah. I can see that because it's one of those types of albums. Seeing it as a concept piece would make it's like it needs to be in that theater sort of atmosphere.
Yep.
But I mean, you know, it's. I mean, it's like
I'm kind of surprised they didn't do a live DVD of it. I thought that it would be something they would have done
because they toured that, didn't they?
They did. They toured the crap. They toured it across America and across Europe.
Yeah.
For some shows in America, I don't know if they ever had. I don't think they. I know they didn't bring an orchestra with them everywhere because that would have bankrupted them. They were playing that to tape. But I would have thought they would have done at least one gig where they had an orchestra and done the full production for a DVD of some sort.
Putting all that production already into it, I couldn't imagine it would have been that hard to set up cameras. I mean, they've got,
there are a couple of, there are a couple of bootlegs kicking around on the internet if you look hard enough.
I don't think I'm that interested, to be honest. Like, it's one of those albums that I can easily
Well, see,
that's
why I would, yeah, I'm still prepared to give that one the benefit of the doubt if I saw it live. If I saw a live rendition
I would still see it live. Yeah. I mean, I would have to because it's Dream Theater, but I can't see them coming here to do that.
It won't. And it won't happen here. I think I don't think it's going to be a record they're going to bring back out again like Scenes from Memory. Like they're bringing that one around again for the 20th anniversary. Are they going to do that in 20 years' time with The Astonishing?
No, because it ain't fucking Scenes from a Memory. It's
Scenes from a Memory is the seminal Dream Theater album. Yeah. I always, like, people say, oh, Dream Theater, where should I start? Start with that one.
Yeah.
And then... depending on which way you lean, if you're more of a metal guy, I go with Dream.
Lean left, always.
If you're more of a metal guy, if you come from metal, go with Train of Thought. If you're into the prog stuff, go for Octavarium.
Yeah. I mean, I don't really care where people start with Dream Theater. If they want to get into Dream Theater, I say just start from the early and make your way. There is bound to be something that you will like eventually.
Go chronological?
I think it's a safe way because you can hear the evolution of the sound of the band, especially their writing style gets... much more efficient and interesting.
And there's a definite
as well.
Shift once Jordan joins the band.
Shit, yeah, there is.
There's like the era with Kevin Moore, then there's the Jordan era, and then there's that shift.
I love having just synth, just like a nice long, beautiful in the background. Rudis loves to freaking.
Yeah. Oh yeah, he loves all that stuff.
Very fiddly.
For the
timeline of this, we're recording this on the day that Jordan's album has released. Mm. None of us have actually heard it yet. So.
No, actually, which would be great to hear because I mean he's done so many side projects and they're always interesting. I got like
LMR
Road Home.
Oh, the road. Yeah, Andrew Saltmarsh did the cover for that.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Him and Salty are good mates.
Shit.
Yeah. At Jordan's solo show in Melbourne, he was there.
Huh.
For those of you not aware, Andrew Saltmarsh is the guy who does all of Toehider's album covers.
Yeah.
He does all of Toehider's album covers. I got to meet Salty. Nice guy.
He seems like a top bloke.
Yeah. Nice
Great
guy.
Artist. Great
oh,
artist.
Oh, fantastic artist. Mm. I've got some of his art hanging out at home.
I remember watching, I think it was Nights with Mike on YouTube.
Yeah.
He had like a little thing. And... you know, sometimes, you know, Salty would be sitting there.
Salty's
like
sitting around,
giving him some shit and just drawing in the corner. But, yeah, speaking of that show, he did so many brilliant covers. And you could just say, can you play some Rush? And he would just do the whole, I think he did Farewell to Kings.
Yeah.
God, he's a brilliant man.
Yeah, he's a fan. We started talking about how you managed to open for Lepros. How did that happen?
Oh, yeah, that was a big
tangent,
wasn't it?
Well,
I suppose the first part of that story is opening for Caligula's Horse. That led us on the way to Lepros. I actually had one singing lesson from Jim Gray, which helped me quite a bit. I forgot a few things. Sorry, Jim. That sort of once he heard what my voice sounded like from our single, that Dreamland State that I sent him, he was pretty happy with it, and he said, why haven't you been our open band before? So I was like, yeah, Jim, why not?
what is the deal? So when locally within Australia, the band like Caligula's Horse, for example, will book their own opening bands, I guess, in that like in each city they'll.
I remember Jim saying he doesn't really have a say, but he was going to put in a good word for us and see what he can do.
Generally up to the whims of the promoter then, I guess.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Wild Things Presents was the ones running the show at that time.
So
And I'm pretty sure because they did the Leprous thing as well. And I'm pretty sure that's how we got it.
Okay, because you'd opened for Caligula's Horse on one of their. They were then in charge.
But we had actually sold
very, I suppose, surprised because we were pretty much unheard of. We were just, I don't know, talked about it.
It's the first time I'd heard about you guys, because I wasn't at that Caligula's Horse Show, unfortunately. But the first time I'd heard you guys was opening for Lepros, and I was like, damn, these guys are good.
But that's why, like, we busted our ass to sell tickets as well, because, like, apparently we heard from the promoter through the Caligula's that we was the... We sold the most
in Australia of the opening bands,
Yeah. Wow. So I think that's why they asked us again, because they knew we could...
You draw a crowd.
We bust our ass to, like, get people to our gig, because we don't play that often.
Like, that's my favourite band of all time, Caligula's Horse is, and pretty high up on K-Man's list as well. So I was busting my ass. I was working for it, and I was going to make sure we did a good job, really, performance-wise, and obviously doing the legwork and promoting, handing out flyers.
Getting people to actually turn up to the show, which is so hard to do in this country. I mean, look how many people turned up and saw the Toehider play.
Yeah. I got a flyer to Ian Kenny, though. That was handy. Yes, Ian Kenny actually came to
He apologised that he didn't see us because he came in after.
He missed us,
And he's like, oh, I heard you was like 70s punk stuff. So I'm like, yeah, we kind of, I should come see us, you bastard. I love you, but come see us.
Also, that gig at the, I was, after I came out from interviewing Mike at the Ocean gig, that was like a who's who of the Perth scene. Ooh, some of the guys from Tangled Thoughts were there. I didn't see.
I think Simone was there as well from Voyager.
Yeah, Simone was there. I think one of the other guys from Voyager was there as well.
Ash would have been there.
Yeah,
I remember seeing the bearded man.
Rumor has it that one of the guys from Carnival was there, but I don't know the many of them by face. No,
yeah,
so
Dave, the guitarist, I'm pretty sure he was.
Someone told me that he was there, but I did. I don't know them by face that well, so I wouldn't have, even if I bumped into him, I wouldn't have known. So, but apparently, so that was like a who's who of the Perth prog scene were there that night. Yeah.
It's very, very small scene, this one.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's why we got the Leprous support gig was through Wild Things Presents and us doing a hopefully satisfactory job in the Caligula's Horse gig. So that would be the reasoning behind that, eh?
I know that Dave in the tickets was pretty happy with us. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that helps if you sell.
Get the fuck on with Leprous there. Sell some tickets.
And how was that show? How did that show go for you?
It started off a bit iffy. Yeah. Leprous, they had a really bad day.
Yeah, they had some equipment stolen.
Yeah. And it was hot as well. Yeah. It was pretty hot.
It was, that was in the middle of January, that gig, so it was pretty hot.
I remember seeing the guys rock up in the little bus, and they were just like slumped over and like looking out the window like this.
I mean, they must have had like a terrible plane ride. I mean, it was delayed or something. I mean,
I think that tour was something like 6 shows in 7 days or something ridiculous. This is always the problem when they come. Like, Haken's run of shows is, 6 shows in 7 days. Yeah. Anathema were the same. By the time they got to Perth, they were absolutely exhausted.
Yeah.
Daniel was crook with a flu as well. So, and they were pretty burnt out because it was like, fly show, and
it's hard to keep it up. I would have, especially the distances. I mean, that's just nuts. But Leprous,
we're just having to fly in and then do a show on the same day.
It's pretty intense.
Yeah, I mean, everything has to be up early. You got to be up at to get on the plane to get to the next gig. Yeah. To get there in time.
Won't play till like 11 o'clock, 10 o'clock at
night. Yeah, they go until 9:30, 10 o'clock. So it's a bloody long day, and then they have to then get up and go again. Yeah. So.
I did get to play on the Leprous kit. It wasn't his kit. It was like it was a nice Pearl kit. I've never really played Pearl before.
How does that work? Was the promoter usually produce the backline or the drums and stuff?
Usually, I mean,
it's that one company that does it every time.
The only one in town. Yeah.
Isn't it called Backline? Or
it is Backline.
So I know when I saw Anathema play, Vince was particularly cheesed off with they'd had a lot of problems with guitar amplifiers to the point where he actually set it on stage. Can somebody please tell the promoter that his guitar amplifiers are shit? Because apparently he'd blown three guitar amplifiers in the sound check. And
oh my God.
The VIP bit was, I wasn't in that, but there were friends of mine who were. That was delayed because they were having problems trying to sound check. Apparently everything was plugged. This was at the Roseman as well.
Oh shit.
Everything was plugged into like one PowerPoint. Plug around the back. Jamie, the bass player, was essentially playing like almost backstage because they couldn't fit everybody on.
Not the right stage for that band.
I don't understand why anybody plays at the Rosemount, frankly, but...
Yeah, have they still got that bloody bar in the middle?
No, they've got rid of that. They moved the bar off to one side now. Smart. They have changed it. It still sounds like... the gig still sounds like a pig on a barrel, but...
Oh, I've only had... semi-good experiences with the sound there. Like,
yeah, we played
it
there.
It used to be okay, but I think they were kind of halfway through the renovation of the place or something. I'm not sure, but that gig in particular was terrible.
Damn.
Well, that's Russian Circles will be playing there in a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Russian Circles, We Lost the Sea, and Tangled Thoughts of Leaving.
I would like to see Tangles.
Mm.
Haven't seen them for a long time. I think the last time I saw them was at like some dingy hotel. I can't remember. It's somewhere in
Perth. I've seen them play at Badlands a bunch of times.
Mm. Oh, this was years ago.
They used to play at the Bakery way back in the day. Was it in Fremantle? Was it their album launch?
No, it was in the city. And this was like, I can't even remember what tour it was, but it was probably like 7 years ago.
Oh, goodness.
This was ages ago.
I went through a phase where I didn't miss a show of theirs for 2 years.
Yeah.
So I've seen them play a whole bunch of times.
I've not seen them yet.
You haven't?
Yeah. No, I've only heard little bits. You need to rectify that situation immediately. Yeah.
I mean, you said you like, what, Sleep Makes Waves? I think Tangled are better than them. No offense to Sleep Makes Waves.
That's in the post-metal scene. It's kind of the East Coast, West Coast thing. The East Coast guys, like Dave, like Sleep Makes Waves a lot. I'm a big Tangled fan because I've seen them play a whole bunch of times.
Yeah.
And they've been on the show.
I think it's that familiarity sort of thing.
Exactly. Especially because Sleep Makes Waves play a whole bunch on the East Coast. They don't tend to make it over here all that often. No. They do occasionally. I've seen them play here twice.
Okay.
So we
did see them once.
We are kind of like opposite in our music tastes as well. Like we like a lot of the same stuff, but for our own reasons.
Yeah.
Like I like more like dreamy, plush, sort of floating, nice music.
Yep.
Which is more Sleep Makes Waves, I suppose. Yep. And he would like. I think Tangled's more like kind of.
It's the Sleep Makes Waves.
There's an influence.
I mean, there's kind of like there's a lot of noise.
So I'm not a big Crimson
minimalism
fan myself. So that's like
fair enough.
He likes dysfunctional, weird, crazy,
I'm a
quirky.
Freak, you know?
And I like sounding catchy. Sort
it's
of
the same story
stuff.
Between Dave and I. Dave's a big metalhead. I'm tending to the more prog sort of jazz sphere, you know, all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
It's probably the best thing about me and Jesse when we like write together is we always have the idea in our head that we're not the only ones that are hopefully going to end up listening to this. So try to make it listenable for others. Like
that's where I come in.
That's where we try to like
make it catchy as fuck.
Yeah, like we try to produce each other, you know, to a point.
Yeah.
So kind of the pop and sort of pop influence or pop rock influences and the real heavier prog elements.
Not even heavier, just more intricate, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean Yes and Genesis is not exactly heavy, but I mean they have some heavy-ish sections when you hear them live.
Yeah, absolutely. Dancing with the Moonlit Night, for example. That's my favorite song still.
Yeah.
That guitar section to play, man.
How much of an asshole do I want to be? Yeah, I've seen Steve Hackett play that song live too.
Dickhead.
He headlined Big Pong, my friend, last year. Steve Hackett was headlining.
Yeah, you know what? There's some people that you meet that you immediately just go, fuck you, give me your life and give me all the previous concert experiences you've had.
Yeah.
Like, I've seen a lot of gigs, but, man, you've seen some bloody brilliant ones.
But we've
ones.
Seen some good gigs too, man.
Yeah, but this...
Did you see The Hand Cannot Erase, Stephen Wilson?
Yeah, I saw them play New Tracks.
That was awesome.
I've seen that. That's the only time I've seen Stephen Wilson play, though. Yeah. I've missed him every single time he's been to Australia. Yeah. I haven't, he's never played here, but.
The
I've
Melbourne show was amazing.
Yeah, I've missed him every single time he's played here. I did have a ticket to the Melbourne show, but work got in the way and I had to sell the ticket, unfortunately. I did have a ticket to his last show here, but.
That production's insane.
He's definitely going for that kind of big Pink Floyd thing with the screens and the lights and all the stuff. He's definitely going in that direction, which is why he played in a seated theater.
But the sound.
Apparently he's got
the sound
a list.
Was phenomenal. Fantastic.
I heard secondhand from a Bulgarian concert promoter that he has a very specific list of requirements for gigs he wants to play in.
Well,
it's definitely going more towards the theater end of sort of things rather than stand up rock gigs.
He wants the room to be not sounding like a complete toilet bowl.
Yeah, exactly.
It's still happening too much.
Yeah.
There's too much volume.
King Crimson goes the same way as well. They're playing effectively theatres now. It's a theatre gig.
So they should.
Yeah.
I don't think I've clearly heard a vocalist in Perth yet.
Mm.
Unless it's like a bigger sort of gig. But
keyboard players tend to get lost in the mix quite a bit.
But the music just goes, it's too
loud.
You guys have got that one sorted.
Sean,
let the thrash metal and death metal bands do what they want. It's because that's the thing. It needs to be loud.
You're going there for is you're going for that experience of that wall of sound coming off the stage. Yeah. Shit ton
you're
of bass,
punched in the
big
face.
Drums, all that sort of stuff. When you, But, the prog thing doesn't.
But not even just prog, like pop, like rock, any sort of alternative like thing needs to be heard, because people use their vocals differently than like say heavier bands. Like there's a lot more. There's you miss too much when the music's louder than the vocals. And
post rock has that problem as well, because you've got that, you know, that guitar sound, which is a lot of reverb, a lot of drench, and then that tends to take up everything, and then the bass comes in. And you just, it's all gone. It's all gone.
And with prog, you kind of want to have definition above loudness.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yep. I mean, because if you can't hear every instrument, then you're not hearing the entire song. And I hate not hearing the bass in the mix, because the way Dario, he plays it like a guitar. So
he does. He winds all the low and treble and plays it like a lead guitar. Very much a Chris Squire. Like we was talking about Chris Squire.
Yeah,
that's the you know,
his tone is, when he puts on that distortion, it's reminiscent of Geddy, like tone, like almost on the money.
Yeah. Geddy's very influenced by Chris Squire as well. Sort of John Entwistle as well. That very much lead instrument bass sort of situation.
Yeah. John Paul Jones.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a bass like fan, obviously Jack Bruce and everything. But there's so many bass players that I like, and not even specifically their tone, just because they've been a part of my favorite music. And
especially when you've got 3-piece instrumental bands. You know, you were talking about Jack Bruce, John Paul Jones, Geddy,
Greg Lake.
Yeah, 3-piece. The bass kind of has to take up a bit more space.
Oh, hell yeah.
Because you haven't got a huge amount of, you know, there's no, you know, they haven't got a second guitar or anything like that. You've got to take up a lot of that space.
Yeah.
You guys seem to have that sort of problem, because you've got the guitar and the keyboards and the bass.
Well, they're usually fighting over the space.
That is the problem, isn't it?
Well, to a point. I mean, you can comment on that.
We're sort of in a bit of a change period. We're trying to not be as busy and nuts all the time. We're trying to add some dynamic to the music, a bit more space. I need some more space to sing, because I'm struggling here. I need some space for myself.
Especially when if you're trying to do some of the high stuff, you kind of need somewhere to put it.
Well, I've been sort of working on our own sort of the last few songs we wrote, by myself, and I've just been coming up with I've been growing as a singer. I've been learning how to use my voice, like little bits of falsetto and like just texture really. And I couldn't do that because it was so busy and loud before, like everything was going, and I didn't have that soft space to like work on it. But it
can be a challenge to pull off live as well, to try and get. I know some vocalists need a lot of I don't know what they use, but they use stuff on the stage to get the voice in a space that it works.
Yeah.
Others could just rip up with a microphone and
I'm scream that person.
Off. Yeah.
But a little bit of reverb's nice. That's I like to keep things a bit simple and more. It sounds raw, but like I try and get it perfect as well. I like raw, but I like well produced. So I like to sit in the middle.
You were talking about your singing there. You write all the lyrics as well?
Yes. Most, like Sean wrote some lyrics.
Okay.
Like we had a writing session for Dreamland State, and like
I'll shout off.
I think I shouted off like Fear No More, blah, blah, blah. And then we just the whole song came out of just like an idea.
He just sort of gives me bits of rope and I just run with it.
Yeah. And he makes the words sound like, how you say, less cheesy. Because I mean, I like cheesy, funny lyrics, you know.
There's the Zapper influence again.
Yeah, I mean, lyrics are lyrics. I mean, I like them to be meaningful if they can be, but, you know, there's nothing wrong with a bit of comedy.
Yeah.
Just ask Mike Mills.
Exactly. I mean,
that's one of the big questions that I always wanted to know from him. Where does that come from?
Yeah.
He's in sort of country rock kind of background. There's a lot of storytelling in that, obviously, and he's bloody good at it.
Yeah.
You know, I still hold up You and I Both Lose But Five Wins as just
okay.
That is it. I mean, once I understood what the fuck it's about, it's a crazy. It's like, where the hell did that one come from,
dude? He's got so many cool ideas and just odd ideas. I mean, the way he writes, he's one of my idols. Like, if people haven't heard Toe Hider, go listen to Toe Hider. It's stupidly interesting. Oh, yeah. Like, it's really good. Like, really good. And if you do want to have, like, obviously good vocals, good guitaring, and just good written songs, listen to Toe Hider.
And Whatever Makes You Feel Superior is probably one of the best songs ever.
Millions of Musketeers is a good one.
Gosh. Dude, I still love, like, you know,
I like the older stuff as well.
You know, those little,
I like A Ghost in the Lake. And that first, I think it's the first album. It's pretty solid all the way through.
I came to Toyota quite late, so I came to it when What Creature Am I came out.
Oh, that's so very late.
Yeah. It was my missus that turned me on to them, actually. They were playing they were doing the Birds Robe Collective 10th anniversary gig in Sydney a couple of years ago. I was living on the East Coast back then. And the missus sent me a link. It was like, go to this gig, see Toe Hider, they are amazing. How the hell she found out about it, I don't know.
So I can't quite. Your missus told you.
My missus told me about it, yeah.
Good woman
there. Yeah, exactly. Her and I share a lot of musical tastes. We're both into Morelian and a lot of prog stuff as well.
Oh, that's awesome. Very lucky. Fans.
Yeah, no wonder you locked that down.
Yeah, exactly. So she turned me on to that, and I went to see the gig. And that was not long after, I think, mostly Songs About Robots had just come out.
Oh, far
so
out.
It was around then.
And that's got a rock version of Gridlines on it.
Yeah.
I remember hearing Gridlines on acoustic, like Glenn showed. He's like, you got this new album. And I'm like singing all the lyrics. And he's like, how do you know this song? I'm like, it's an old song, dude. Like,
yeah. It's been around for a while. Yeah. So yeah, that record had just come out. And I think not long before that, What Creature Am I had just come out as well. So he was playing a lot of stuff from those two records. Yeah. So that was my starting point. Then he did the next one. God, was it This Conversation Is Over?
This Conversation Is Over.
Yeah, This Conversation Is Over. That was the next one.
Mm. I like the video clip. It's quite retro.
It's quite fun. Yeah. There's a lot of great songs on that next record, This Conversation Is Over.
I've got the download. That's literally where I've got to on that. I haven't had any spare cash to buy Toe Hider, and I refuse to just... I respect him too much to not purchase his material.
The reason why I subscribed to his Patreon was for salty zines that he was supposed to be doing, which he kind of hasn't done. But he acknowledged that was a horrendous undertaking that he took on. He's now going to compile it all into one giant art book.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. It's like $16.99 a month or something to support him. And Michael release, you know, stuff he's working on. Here's a track.
Yeah.
There's a CD that's going to be coming out where he's got all the tracks are on a SoundCloud account.
Yeah.
And he's going to put all of them on a CD and ship it sometime. Oh, wow. Yeah. The idea eventually is that the fans will pick the songs.
I heard you could pay to like write a song with him as well. Like,
yeah, if you want to pay. There's a Patreon. I think there's a Patreon pledge or something. It was some outrageous amount of money.
Yeah, but he'd probably be worth it, eh? It'd be fun.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be fun to write a song with that guy.
You guys should do it.
Hey, yeah. Well, hey. Eventually, we got this.
We'll start saving.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll be worth it.
Yeah. Whatever it is, a couple of $100 or something, I think.
I mean,
I might as well just save more and get him to just sing for our band, really.
I mean, if he doesn't mind performing and then get paid in burgers, that's all good.
I think he might need actual cash.
Damn it.
He must like burgers, though.
Burgers are good.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Yeah, but Toe Hider, man. Mm. That's one of the obviously you would have heard then Geese Liking with the Trollhagen guy.
Geese Liking. I saw Trollhagen play at that Birds Robe Collective gig was basically all and sundry of the Perth sort of underground scene. Mm. Mike actually opened this whole show. It was a 10 or 11 hour gig or something. It started at 1 in the afternoon and finished at midnight. Damn. And he opened that gig just him and acoustic guitar. He played, what did he play? I think he played Salisbury Hill. He played a bunch of other stuff as well. Yeah, he didn't do Wuthering Heights though.
No,
guys shouted for.
Yeah, well, we're sort of to piss him off, basically. Because, we don't expect him to do them, but it's.
Oh, God. I went looking for the YouTube clip because I wanted to watch it again. He did it himself. He pulled it down.
Yeah, because he was getting too many views, eh?
No, getting too many trolls.
Oh, really?
People were giving him crap. They were saying, they were making jokes about his bald head. They were saying, oh, it's fake. It's been auto-tuned. It's not real.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, he was getting, he got involved in a back and forth and eventually got fed up with it and pulled it down.
I got so pissed off when it got pulled down because I'm like, where's that video? I can't show anyone how amazing this guy is.
I went looking for it because I wanted to put it in the show notes on one of our previous shows. I went looking for it and it's not there. I assumed it was a copyright claim that Kate Bush had found owns the song and went, nah, gone. He dragged it down himself.
I think I might have downloaded it.
Ooh.
From the fucking...
Oh, you downloaded it from YouTube using one of those things you're not supposed to use.
I did. Yeah, I mean, I did it for the, Friday, Mikes and Mikes Friday nights or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
I did it for that because I couldn't watch it download it and then watch it when I can. I just loved having it in the background. You know, he would say some funny jokes. He's just an all cool guy and like
I didn't get the
musician.
Whole talk about Daffy Duck and all that. Yeah. I didn't really understand
it. Do it once.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I was just, yeah. The trolls on the internet, man. What can you do?
I just can't believe that they would let it get to him because he's, I mean, surely he knows, like, that he's good. Like,
yeah.
Doesn't need to have people's validation.
Well, it had 500,000 views, for goodness sake, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure half of them were my own watching.
I've watched it a few times as well. Yeah. I always tell people don't read the comments.
I'm sure anytime I was drunk with my mates, I'm pretty sure I searched for it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we've done that a lot.
Yeah.
Check out what this man can sing.
Yeah.
And then I show people the, what was it, 011, when the Arion, new Arion album?
Yeah.
The Source, yeah.
Yeah.
And Arion just goes, yeah, go and write it. Like, of course you're going to let him do it. He's a literal, he's Queen in one man.
Absolutely.
I still haven't listened to that album.
Haven't you? Oh, man.
I've listened to it a couple of times, but it's not on regular
rotation. I love the theory of everything. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I love that album.
That's a good one. It's on the poster behind his head.
Yeah. And you got the shirt too.
And I do have a signed LP of it as well.
Ooh, nice. Signed by
Arion.
Arion. Mm. Yeah. When did you guys meet Arion?
I didn't. I just purchased it online.
Ah, right.
So he didn't really get it signed.
Well, the other thing is as well, he doesn't tour.
No.
He did that gig at, which festival was it?
It was in Europe somewhere.
Yeah, it was in the Netherlands somewhere. I forget which one it was though. There are so many festivals in the Netherlands and I still haven't been to a single one. Where he got everybody together. You know, Mike flew over for the gig. I think Salty was there. They all flew in and they did the big ensemble performance of the show.
That would have been so good to see.
Yeah. I'm pissed off I missed that. Like something else was. I was in Europe when it happened, but I wasn't in the Netherlands. I was somewhere else. Can't remember where.
And just to see the Equation, like live, I think it was a theatre production.
Yeah, that went pretty well.
I got the DVD of that.
I don't know if the festival one was filmed. Film does exist of it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think filming at festivals is always tricky.
It would be. Mm. Everyone's like, don't do it, don't do it. And the sound is never going to be that great.
Sound's never going to be good. Trying to set it all up and properly do a check, because you don't really get a sound check at a festival gig, of course.
Yeah. On you go. Plug and play.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, it's same in Perth. Like, I mean, if you're not the, like, basically first band or last band, you get line check and off you go kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's not comfortable.
Mm.
And I think that's pretty much why we, not the main reason, but it's one reason we don't always play particular venues, just they're not really comfortable to be in.
Maybe we can cut this, but you want to name some?
Oh, we will play anywhere, but like, you don't want to have to play everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm like, kind of not picky. I don't care.
Yeah.
I just go and play shit.
I suppose it's different for you as a drummer, though, because you've kind of got you got to try and project and how it sounds.
He's just a bit more of a dick than I am, and he's a bit picky.
I'm a bit picky, yeah. I am a bit picky.
Yeah.
But, I mean,
I've complained loudly enough about the Roseman on this show enough, so.
Yeah, but, I mean, rightly so. Like, I mean, you wouldn't be complaining about it if it was a fantastic fucking venue. Mm. Like, and this is what I'm saying.
I mean, people like to shit on the Perth Arena a lot. It sounds good.
Sounds great.
Sounds a hell of a lot better than either the Perth Entertainment System or the Burswell Dome ever did.
Oh, Burswell Dome, don't even get me started on that fucking shithole cockroach. That is.
Well,
Metallica sounded good there.
But the thing is,
lower in volume.
The thing is, they built it. Sounded like shit when they built it. Sounded like shit all the way through. And then they bulldozed it.
Yeah.
I mean, apparently the first gig that was playing there was the Stones. And apparently it sounded like arse.
Yep, would have. Definitely would
and
have.
The venue.
And the venue. Oh, that's a dig of Stones.
I saw the Stones play in Prague. Now that they're at the level they are, they can have the fantastic sound system. It sounded fantastic. Mm. You can argue the toss about whether you like the Stones or not.
Yeah.
Fantastic. As good as the record.
I do. Everyone's in like two, you know, there's either Beatles fans or like.
Beatles or the Stones, yep.
I would have to say Beatles for me.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah. Like, I agree, the Beatles for me as well, but I still do like the Stones.
Better quality of musician, really.
I mean, if they came to play in Australia, would I pay the outrageous sum of money they were charging for tickets?
No. It's like, I can't justify paying, $150 to see Metallica in the shittiest seats.
Yeah.
Sorry, not.
Way out the back,
yeah.
Up the top. Apparently that venue also sounds particularly terrible.
And with a big venue with a big band like that, it's you're going to have big sound delays unless they have a lot of speaker stacks.
Even then, I mean, just because it's being played through a tannoy doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be any good.
That's true.
Cough, Guns N' Roses, cough. I saw them play in Barcelona, and that was the worst sounding gig I've ever been to in my entire life. Because they were playing at a giant stadium, the stadium they used for the 92 Olympics. So they were 1,000 miles over that way. It was being played through a tannoy, and this tannoy was crap. Sounded like a cheap car stereo that had been thumped with a baseball bat.
Fuck.
It was awful.
That's not good. So what did Chaos Divine actually say about how they get all their bloody opening gigs?
Basically, they've been like, you know, sending lots of stuff to promoters.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, so they try to get in good with the promoters. They've had a couple of opening slots. I mean, I think they opened for Slayer at one point.
Yeah, a few. I think they must have got in good,
and then they sort of, you know, they've not every time they come to Perth, they're kind of on the bill for a lot of metal, prog, that sort of stuff. I guess
they're a bloody great live band,
And also as well, I think they draw a big crowd.
Shit, yeah.
You see, oh, Chaos Divine's on the bill, I'm going.
Yeah.
Even if I'm not a particularly big fan of the headliner, which frankly is The Ocean for me, I wasn't a big fan of The Ocean,
but I did go to see literally Toe Harder. I'd flew in like 2 days before, and I'm like, yes, I'm here for Toe Harder. Like, I was
there for Toe Harder and Chaos Divine.
It was kind of like, do I see Toe Harder or do I go and see The Prodigy? That was on the same night.
Yeah, it was on the same night.
Looking back on it now.
Now he's dead.
Yeah, I was going to say, looking back on it now, oh dear.
Yeah.
But I missed that one, but.
To be honest, Toe Harder kicks Prodigy ass.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a completely different space. Oh, you know, we've got a metal gig versus...
I mean, why not have both?
I mean, I love Prodigy's music only to a point. That's party music, you know?
Yeah.
It's not the good, it's not the bad, but it's definitely good
in parties. We were talking about this earlier off air that there are... I always thought there were two kinds of music, good and bad. You've thrown in a third category, good, bad, and party music.
Yeah. Fuck yeah.
Because there's some songs you just really don't want to listen to by yourself.
Yeah. Sitting down at home with the headphones on, you know, there's that kind of music, and then there's the other kind of music which is kind of sounds great, crank through a stereo at a party.
Exactly.
You're sitting around with your mates, you're having a beer, you're having a barbecue, whatever, there's stuff you want to listen to.
Yep. Absolutely perfect.
I'm a big fan of Throwback Thursdays. Like Throwback Thursdays. 90s disco pop shit.
Oh, yeah.
And only on Thursdays though, all party. So that's party music. That's I wouldn't listen to that normally, like for a pleasure, like with headphones on.
So I think for the opening for bands and stuff, I think it was like if the like you guys did it well with Leprosy, you know, you show you can draw a big crowd.
You just got to bust your ass. Like, yeah.
There's no shortcuts. There's no sort of cheap ways around it.
No, but it was a
shortcut. Work we really did have hard on your music.
Yeah, but I mean, when we did get that opportunity, we busted our ass to make a good impression to hopefully get asked again. And hey, it worked.
There's another band, Anubis. They're in the traditional prog sphere. And when they got on the bill at Night of the Prog in Lorelei, they went out of their way to make sure that they had everything. That is their audience.
Yeah.
The Night of the Prog, it's not a metal thing. It's very much the traditional prog. A lot of guys on the reunion circuit doing that gig. Yeah. So they wanted to make sure they got in good with them to get invited back.
Bloody oath.
Multiple times.
Yeah. It makes sense. Like, if you get those opportunities and you don't take them, that's when you're going to kick your own ass. Like, that's when you just hate yourself. And who hates hating themselves?
Exactly.
I hate hating myself. So I try never to.
Yeah. It's a damn shame that Big Prog, my friend, doesn't exist anymore. Because they had, well, the first time I went, they had Caligula's Horse on, and then they had Pliny.
No.
And if they'd had a third one, I would have been badgering the shit out of the promoter to get Toe Harder on the NAMM bill.
Yeah, especially when you've got that many Aussie bands already going.
Yeah, but they also as well for Big Prog, my friend, they were trying to straddle the line between traditional prog and metal. So one night they had a Perfect Circle headlining. The second night they had Steve Hackett headlining. You couldn't have picked two further bands at each end of the prog stream if you tried.
That's true.
So they were trying to – and the year after that it was the big band they had – they had Morellian on one night, they had Jethro Tull, they had Devin Townsend there, Mike Portnoy, Shadow Fortress was around, so they were trying to, Animals as Leaders was on the bill as well, so they were definitely trying to straddle that space between the two.
Heavy and the standard rock,
so you had all the prog guys who were like, scared off by the heavy metal, then you had all the heavy metal guys who were bored to tears by the prog.
Yeah.
Like the traditional prog stuff.
But the weird thing is, like, even when, because, you know, in Perth there's not many prog bands around, like, so we always get lumped in with metal bands.
Yep.
Yeah.
But it's we don't 100%. Really mind because the metal guys still that, actually appreciate musicianship.
Yes, so like exactly.
When they see us play, they're like, oh, you aren't that shit at your instruments. You just choose to play softer music.
Yeah.
And that's literally kind of is. It's hard to describe what we sound like.
That's why I threw that growl in at the end of our song.
Work's a treat, though.
Yeah.
Because like, people are like, I didn't know you could fucking do that. And I'm like, yeah, man.
You would not know he was in Ivy.
I was in a black metal band. Yeah. Well, kind of a casual band now. We're trying to get things going. But and that's like Lamb of God mixed with like, I don't know, like Meshuggah and like Opeth. Okay. Bit of Opeth.
A lot of the sort of more the real heavy end of the things.
Yeah. So like we were all Metallica heads and like thrash heads. We all love Korn and like things like that. So yeah, that was my before Crypt Keys.
You played bass on that.
I played bass and sung for that, yeah.
Cool.
Mm. Sick.
So we might hear some more growls in future.
Yeah.
Crypt Keys music, but unexpected ones, so it scares the shit out of you.
That's it.
Like, you wouldn't do a whole song? You wouldn't do a whole, you couldn't do a whole thing?
Depending on what the lyric was, I suppose, if it sort of fit, if it
I
fit
think
the song.
Dynamics is more important than having heaviness for that long. Like,
yeah.
If it fits the part,
if it's
the
song that needs it, then yeah.
We've never objected.
Serve the song. We ask the song what it wants. That's what happens.
Right. And we choose to try and never say no, because you can always change it after you've tried it.
So yeah.
Just try it out.
And we tried it live, and people seemed to like it.
Yeah.
Especially Dan from Agnesis, he seemed to like it.
I'm pissed off. I missed that show.
We had an after party at their place as well. That was
right.
Yeah. I don't want to talk about much. Yeah.
That was good. Long night, though, man.
Anytime I hang out with the two Dans, shit goes a bit sideways.
Yeah.
We all went to bed at a decent time, I think, maybe about 5:30.
Yeah, I went to bed in the morning. At least 4, I think. Yeah.
Sounds like a big night.
It was. Yeah. It's always fun with these guys because, like, they're just really good mates. And like, any time we have a gig, they'll make the effort to come down. And we'll do the same for them. And like, it's a bummer that like my schedule and stuff didn't work out with them because they like. I mean, I'd started learning their material as well because they were going through a drummer issue. So I was like, I'll learn your stuff just. So if you do have a gig, you know, we can do the gig, but please find a drummer because I got my own thing. I don't want to be
exactly.
Like, it's hard being.
It is an old rock cliche, the like the drummer is in four bands sort of thing.
Mm. Kind of, yeah. Mm. I mean, but I'm not one of those massively talented drummers. Like, I mean, Ash from Voyager can just play anything in any band and does
the new
it
drummer
brilliantly.
That Chaos Divine have got, Tim, he's quite the same. He's more in the metal sphere.
Mind you, I did see that when they did do the Badlands, he did mess up a song. I did notice that.
And I think that might have been like the first little. I don't think he's been with the band all that long.
It was his first show with the band, and I'm like, I mean, hopefully you cut it out because I don't want to like point it out, but it was the one thing I noticed. And then I'm like, I remembered Mike Mills was out the front, so I went and talked to him. Got a good couple of photos. I'm sure he was pissed off at me by the end of the night.
Chaos Divine's one of those bands I can't help but headbang to.
Oh, don't worry. You weren't the only super fan who was like hanging off him all bloody night. I know there was a few others as well.
Yeah. I tried to not take too much of his time.
That's why I was kind of like hold back a bit. I was like,
I just hope I didn't piss him off. I'm sure I did. I was pretty pissed. But it was a great gig.
Yeah. So we'll get to the final question that I usually ask, and it's a bit of a theme on the show. Tell us something that we don't know about you.
Like personally or as a band?
As a band?
Either or. As a band is probably more fun.
You go first or whatever.
I've got to think of it. I mean,
I've got to think of one.
This is editing.
Okay. Oh, don't worry. Everybody has to think about this one.
Yeah. Something interesting.
Well, to give a perspective, when I asked Mike this question, I found out it's colorblind.
Holy
completely
shit.
Completely colorblind. Oh, more or less completely colorblind.
Did not know that.
Neither did I.
Wow.
I don't know. I like to cook. What else?
He cooks good shit.
What's your signature dish?
Something meaty.
Yeah, it's not probably like smoked meats and like roasts and stuff. Yeah.
Briskets. Mm. Oh, that pork was good too.
Pork bellies. I don't know. I like cooking a lot of different things. Always find it fun. I don't know. What else? What else do I like? Just writing music. I mean, we hang out and party a lot with friends and like.
A little bit too much.
Yeah, at this period of time.
We never used to drink like this every weekend, did we?
No. Every Saturday we caught up and jammed and wrote stuff. And
we were productive and now we're just off chops.
Yeah, after those two gigs we're like, we've done it. We've done it all. Those two gigs actually, like, was the thing that we're like, we need to fucking keep moving forward. Like, yeah. So, you know,
good. It just felt good to do it again. Yeah. We hadn't had a gig in a year and a year and a half.
Mm.
Something like
since
that.
Since the Leprous.
Leprous was our last gig before those two gigs.
Yeah. But that's when Sean left down Bunbury, yeah. So
that doesn't help.
No, it doesn't, especially when he's pretty much like, I mean, it's me, Jesse,
he's pretty
and Sean
he's,
writing.
Mm.
Like,
we're all pretty equally integral in the band's makeup. Like,
in terms of writing new music.
Yeah.
Well, like, for instance, if we didn't have Dario, our songs wouldn't sound nearly as cool on the low end. Like, he is a
absolutely
monster.
Well, he's works with him.
Yeah.
He gives him ideas, and just that's why he plays things in a certain way, and that's why Dario plays things in a certain way, because that's pretty much you guys sort your own shit out, and me and Sean are just like writing stuff on top. Or
but then Dario will go to Sean, and then
tell Sean not to play so deep.
Yeah. So what's interesting about you? Like something interesting.
Something
Jesse.
That no one knows about me.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Loves karaoke.
Yes, I'm a big fan of karaoke.
As a vocal, as a vocalist in a band, you like karaoke. You say it, isn't so.
Yeah.
Oh no, it is. Something interesting. I don't know.
Interesting. I don't have
He's
much interesting about me. I'm a dad. I'm a single dad.
Mm-hmm.
I like walks on the beach. No, not really. Fuck that.
It's too buggy.
I really don't know anything interesting about myself.
That'll do.
That's actually probably been more interesting. He doesn't know anything
you
interesting.
Help me. You know, you know shit about me.
Single father. He occasionally rides drum beats for me.
My son has a pretty mean afro.
He does have a mean afro.
Mm.
I enjoy the music of Savage Garden.
Yep, I like some tracks too.
I was going to say that.
Wow, that's a better reaction than I thought. Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, they write good pop.
Yeah,
and
it's good pop.
I don't mind Nickelback either, and I'm not afraid to say it.
I like
this.
This
has been a recurring theme on the show about how much crap Nickelback gets from sniffy, snobby punters.
Yeah, but
I'm not a big fan of the early stuff that everyone loves.
I'm not like impartial either way. I think they write some decent rock songs.
Chad Kroeger appears on the new Devin Townsend record. Those two are good mates.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there
was an article kicking around. I don't know where the hell I'd find it again, but where Devin and Chad Kroeger had a meeting, and Devin was like, "Oh, I want to write more sort of poppy stuff," and Chad basically talked him out of it. It's like, "Nah, man, you got your own sound, man. You don't want to be chasing the pop thing."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think that's the basic gist of it.
Okay.
See if we can find the article.
That's cool. That they're both Canadian, obviously.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I mean, Canadians are such
they all
nice
know
guys,
each other.
So they're like,
yeah.
"Oh, we might." Have to
yeah, I think Devin's on the west coast, and I think Chad's on the east coast. But yeah,
yes, yeah.
Mm.
See,
and just down the road,
it's
there's like Celine Dion
not like
down
a
the
terrible
road.
Band. It's like it's like to me, it would be like saying you hate U2. It doesn't make sense to me. How can you hate them?
I don't hate them, but I never found a like sort of. I never wanted to listen to them.
I think it's just a snobby thing that people like to just. You know, people like to piss on Metallica. People like to piss on Nickelback.
Yeah.
It's the thing.
Yeah.
It's the thing to do.
How about talk about things you like instead of things you hate?
Yeah,
this is the whole point of the show, frankly.
Yeah,
we want to talk about music that we like. There's plenty of people out there talking about shit they hate.
Yeah, there's we too much hate in the world. Just spread interesting, fun things. That would be much
exactly
better.
Right.
What do you think of Animals as Leaders?
I really enjoy Animals as Leaders.
Yeah,
this is good stuff. Saw him play once. He's a phenomenal guitar player.
Mm.
Yeah,
I think there's anyone out there and. The quote unquote bass player in his band is actually just playing a 6-string guitar.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose with Tosin playing his 8-string, he's doing most of the kind of
low end.
Yeah, most of the low stuff anyway, so there's kind of nowhere to go.
Yeah. But there's Omnific, the two bass players?
The Omnific, yeah. Dave just recorded an interview with them a couple of days ago. That'll be on the show probably by the time this show is out, you've probably already heard the interview.
Yep. Because, man, that's it. I like that. There's interesting stuff on that.
I've not checked them out yet.
You should. You really should. Two bass players. It's a three-piece. Two bass players and a drummer.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's interesting stuff.
I liked it. Great production.
Mm. I find that hard to listen to as a vocalist guitarist.
Yeah.
<You're> like,
well, instrumental bands is one of the – like, this is
– I'm hit and miss with instrumental bands. I can get bored really easily.
Yeah.
If there's not – if you're instrumental, you've kind of got to be.
It's kind of the problem I have with the later sort of Joe Satriani stuff.
Yep.
When he got away from doing the mad shredding stuff, which frankly gets a bit boring after a while.
Yeah.
Not mentioning any names. Yngwie.
Yeah. He's done that.
Yngwie.
All of his life.
Yeah, basically.
He had some killer songs, though. He had some awesome, like, classic metal tunes.
He did a good version of Gates of Babylon.
This is true. Yeah.
That was a bloody good cover. But then again, I mean, it's hard to beat the original, but I'm a bit biased because grew up with that song, so yeah.
I'm not sure who does that song. Is that bad? Gates of Babylon? What is that? Who is that?
Rainbow, man.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I've only heard like one song from them. Maybe
okay,
two.
It's okay. I'll forgive you, man.
But Dio's not that great anyway.
Fuck off. Dio's a legend.
Now, hang on. I do have a bone to pick with the whole Dio. Now they're doing that whole holographic thing where Dio's on the thing.
Yeah.
That can fuck right off.
I agree.
Apparently, like, they're going to do it with Zappa as well, allegedly.
I've heard that, yeah.
Actually, no, I don't think they're going to do it. I'm pretty sure they already have because somebody tapped Adrian Belew to do it. And he spoke about it, and he got bombed with comments on his Facebook page from people saying, for God's sake, don't do it.
Yeah.
It's a pile of shit. Don't get anywhere near it.
Yeah.
It's a whole – because Dweezil is still out doing the Zappa music. Did you see Dweezil play when he was
– I did, indeed.
Don't the family not want Diesel
exactly.
to –
Exactly. That was the problem. It was the cease and desist. He wasn't allowed – it was used to be called Zappa Plays Zappa.
Yes.
And then he wasn't allowed to say that. He had to call it – Dweezil Zappa plays Frank Zappa, and then he wasn't allowed to say Frank Zappa, so then he was like, I think it eventually became Dweezil Zappa plays whatever the fuck he wants, the cease and desist tour.
Yes.
Because he only gets a small portion from the family trust. The family trust is controlled by his brother and his sister.
Yep.
Apparently the trust is millions of dollars in debt, and this thing is just a way to try and get more money for the thing.
Yeah. Someone who's in charge of a trust somewhere in the world is called Moon Unit.
Yeah, that's his sister.
That's his
and
daughter.
Then he's
I thought it was
sister.
The son. Moon Unit sounds like a boy's name to me.
Armes is the other brother.
Yeah, but Dweezil, like...
You've got to be on some drugs. But he actually wasn't on drugs.
He wasn't on...
No, he was...
Coffee and smokes.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Cigarettes and... Okay, he was just... Yeah, I don't think he drank either. I don't think he was...
No, he said he never liked to... And that's pretty much why Charlie Murphy Brock got kicked out of the band, because he smoked too much weed.
Everybody associates Zappa's music with, like,
drugs.
Whoa, man, stoners, LSD sort of shit. But then you
watch him in an interview with the PMC or
something.
Oh,
yeah, the PMRC,
and you're like, the guys could be running for president back in the day.
It was just an intelligent frog.
People were trying to advocate for it.
Oh, God, he couldn't do that.
He would hate it.
He would hate it, yeah. Well, he said some interesting things about Live Aid.
Oh,
where he walks, I think, I don't know if anyone actually, I doubt anyone actually asked him, but his opinion about Live Aid was that the whole thing, I think he described it as the greatest cocaine smuggling racket in the world or something, because apparently they weren't really addressing systemic problems in Africa. All they were doing was just bombing cash at it, and I'm going to get distributed amongst warlords and whatever.
That's right.
Mm. I mean, instead of actually asking people in need what they want, they just get given whatever the people do. Whatever people just makes them feel superior.
Too hard to plug.
Yeah, they get given clothes or money, generators or stuff. I was watching a video. John Green went over to Sierra Leone to look at a hospital over there, and they've been gifted generators by some American charity, probably associated with a church. The generators were way too powerful for the Sierra Leone power grid and shorted everything out. So it's like, cool, you've spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to ship two generators over here that we didn't ask for,
don't want, and can't use.
Well done, gold star.
Yeah.
That's solid effort.
Yeah.
That's solid. And planning too. That's brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah,
fuck, people are dumb.
Yes, they are.
It just makes me feel comfortable. You know, you've seen people being that dumb, I'm like, at least I didn't do that.
At least I didn't ship two generators to an African hospital in a that they didn't want and can't use.
Exactly. Exactly. I think I would have thought about that a little bit more before I done it.
Well, or at least asked.
Yeah.
Hey, we would like to give you something. We would like to help you. What can we give you?
Like, help me to help you.
Help me to help you. Help me to help you.
You're gold.
Yep.
All right. Anything else interesting about yourself, Jesse?
Oh, I don't know. You can tell one if you want.
I don't know one.
I can't think about it.
Oh, one interesting thing that he does is his drink is – he used to hate beer, but being in Kripke's we always have like different kind of beers come up. So he's become accustomed to liking beers now. But when he's on the cheap end of the whole thing,
oh no,
he'll be having his was it like a $3 bottle of wines with mixed with the orange juice or cranberry juice. It's basically like the poor man's punch.
I thought that's what punch was basically. Like cheap wine mixed with fruit juice and ice cubes.
But punch is usually nice and tasty, but this is just gut rot.
Is it just to get it down?
The sort of thing that people like Jackson Coke for. You know, Jackson Coke is just like you put more Jacks in there if you want
to
get more.
That tastes really nice compared to this.
That was his other drink.
That's what Yeah. Oh, I'm not a picky person. I'm all right.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm fine with anything, really. I go with the flow.
I guess that's the interesting thing.
Yep.
He is just a chilled guy.
I was saying,
no, I was saying, like, what, early in the week, I was watching a whole bunch of Sammy Hagar interviews. I'm like, Jesse just reminds me of Sammy Hagar. Like,
yeah, very chill, just kind of relaxed.
Amazing voice.
Yep.
No ego.
I'm just joking.
Great rhythm guitarist.
Shit lead guitarist.
No. Oh, I was just saying, like, he kind of looks like him a little bit.
A little bit, yeah.
A little bit.
I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, obviously. But he'll get there.
I've got a couple of greys in the side.
But yeah, that's just one other thing. I think it's interesting. Other interesting thing is I like to collect, you know, just Pokemon cards.
Really?
I still have my collection.
From way back in the early 2000s when it was actually popular.
Yeah, I used to sell them.
Really?
Yeah, down at the markets.
Yeah?
Yeah. Used
to make vintage ones?
Nah, all the
original
ones. I heard
he was pretty ruthless
too. The original ones, yeah.
Like, give some of those guys in stalls in Thailand a run for their money when it comes to ruthless selling.
I don't like having cash on me because it's too easy to spend.
I don't know.
If strippers walk past, then it's gone, like, real quick.
Yeah, hang on. If cards are around, it's just easy to whip your card out and go boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, shit, how the hell did I spend $500 this week?
You just need to be better with money, I think. You just got to train yourself.
Well, Sean was showing me all he takes. He doesn't even carry a wallet anymore. He carries his phone and a card.
When I'm at work, I do that. I just have my phone. Well, I used to have another phone with a case on it. You put two cards in it.
Oh,
driver's
yeah.
license, credit card, phone, gone.
All you need, yeah.
Yep.
Hopefully keys.
The keys just live in my bag, but yeah.
It's weird, like, what you can get. I mean, you don't even need the card now. You got cardless withdrawals.
Yeah. And you can pay for stuff with the phone as well.
Tap and pay.
I haven't quite got that far yet. I still carry a card around, but that's a good point.
Mm. I'm not prepared to be a cyborg. Not prepared.
Yeah, also as well.
I'm all just for things being simple.
If your phone gets nicked, then you're in the shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there, yeah, obviously. Mm. But then, hopefully, you've got a password and shit. But then again, it's pretty easy to bypass, so you can reset bloody phones pretty easily.
Yep. I think that about wraps it up.
All right.
All right. Too lovely.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for appearing on the 9-8 podcast.
Thanks for having us. Cheers.